With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify. It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. My name is Hith Lede. I'm the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great ATQ writers, Badwater. How you doing?
I'm much better this week. Last week, I was down and out for the count for half the week with the cold from hell. You know, it's one of those things where you're sore just from laying down for days on end. So, but got over that over the weekend and doing much better.
Well, glad to hear it. You had plenty of recuperation time to be watching the volleyball team on a pretty historic run. They made it to the Elite Eight and were in a position to advance to the Final Four in women's volleyball if they just could have, you know, gotten that match point in the fourth set. How would you, you know, the season is over. Can you give me, like, what's your reaction to this season?
Well, I think that the volleyball team can't look at this as anything but, you know, heck of a success. They benefited from having a rising star in Mimi Collier, and they benefited from the addition of Hannah Pukas as a setter. And, you know, boy, they were just never give up, and it showed. They had a very successful closing run, and it's
oh, yeah,
too bad that
they completely tore up the Pac-12. You know, like, they beat Stanford, who was the Pac-12 champ. Although, interestingly, Stanford went out the same day that Oregon did. They lost in a big upset to San Diego.
San Diego State's the Cinderella right now.
And yeah, but they just completely tore up the Pac-12, with the exception of, like, a three-game streak in which I think it was four matches in which they did not have Mimi Collier, and they lost three of them, and they're like, that was it.
They didn't have Hannah Pukas. Ferreira was setting in her place. She was out with an injury.
So, like, yeah, man, I mean, you can sort of, it's a direct line between the two of those, you know, things. And otherwise, like, they just couldn't be stopped. And then they get to the tournament. You know, they I think they had Loyola Marymount in the first round. Obviously, they clobbered them. They beat Arkansas actually fairly handily, like a little more handily than I was even expecting. And then in the round of 16, They had a, you know, a good dogfight against Nebraska, and at points I was sort of thinking Nebraska kind of looks like maybe the better team, but then Oregon like rallied back and I was like, oh, mate, eat my words. Nebraska's defense is really good. Like that's a lot of really tall ladies, and a lot of like, you know, a lot of blocks that I think, you know, they would have pulled off, you know, against just about any other opponent like Nebraska was blocking.
Well, Nebraska still had twice the blocks of Oregon. Yeah. I mean, they're that good.
Yeah, but Oregon sent them home. And then they drew Louisville in Louisville, right? Like, it would have been, you know, I sort of feel like if that Pucas injury didn't happen and Oregon won the Pac-12, which they, you know, if they tied with Stanford, they would have won, you know, because and gotten the automatic qualifier. Not that they would have, you know, needed the automatic qualifier, obviously, but like they beat Stanford, you know, like I feel if they got a host, like they might have gotten the edge, you know, like they might have made it to the Final Four. I don't want to, you know, causality is just, it's a little too pat to say, like, you know, for want of Hannah Pucas, you know, the horse was lost, et cetera, but like, it does sort of seem like, you know, they were so close against Louisville. And you know, if they had the home crowd advantage instead of, you know, going up against the home crowd advantage, that might've made the difference. I mean, they would have been playing a different team because Louisville would have gotten their home region, but you know what I mean? Like,
right. Well, you know, the Ducks were unbeaten at Matthew Knight Arena and that, home crown advantage can't really be discounted. I'm be willing to wager that virtually all the teams that visited Matthew Knight Arena, maybe even Stanford included, were playing in front of the largest audience.
Entirely possible.
And when you have,
because I mean, the other really good volleyball team in the Pac-12 is Stanford, and you know they ain't showing up. Like they don't even show up for football.
So the fact that Louisville was hosting the regional was significant. There was nearly 8,800 fans there, and that kind of pressure can't be discounted.
I mean, they seemed like smart fans too. That was the other thing, is that like, it definitely felt like the crowd was, you know, they weren't just there cause like, oh, hey, there's a thing and ladies and cool. Like, yeah, man, like they definitely like were following and like cheering and gasping at the right moments. Seemed like a, you know, pretty smart and engaged fan base for their volleyball team, which good for them. That's great. You know, I saw a stat that, you know, that with, you know, Oregon and Stanford's elimination and then a couple losses in the Big Ten, although I think the Big Ten losses were expected, that like there were no Pac-12 or Big Ten teams in the Final Four for, I think, the first time ever in the women's volleyball tournament, you know, which indicates that like the sport is like broadening, you know, nationally. You know, it's one of those things that for a long time sort of been dominated by certain pockets of the country. You know, the Big Ten because there's a tradition there, and the Pac-12 because, well, any Olympic sport is dominated by the Pac-12. You know, pretty much anything but football.
Well, volleyball has also benefited from, you know, it's been what, 23 years now where they had a significant rule change where it used to be before 1999 that you only scored points when you serve. And that had a tendency to really drag the game out. You know,
you mean if you were on the receiving team, on the receiving side, even if you got a kill or whatever, that you didn't get a point, all you did was get the service go to you?
Yes.
And wait, then the opportunity to get a point. Who decided on that one?
Well, that's the way it used to be. I think way back when.
Wait, that's not how we did it in the PE class when I was playing volleyball.
That was.
It was a great underhand server, by the way, if anybody's curious about that. Oh, man, I was killing people with those sky shots.
I was a very defensive person then at the net because wasn't terribly tall.
It's all about anticipation if you don't have the height.
Yeah, no doubt. But with the with the rule change in 99 and having it, having the sides score points regardless of whether they're holding serve or not, it really sped up the game. I mean, volleyball is exciting to watch these days.
I mean, it seems like a match would take twice as long if you can only score when you got the serve. Like,
yeah, and that's the thing. That kind of makes it more easily consumed on media because you're not going to have a match last longer than maybe about 2 hours under any circumstance.
Well, that Louisville match was, first of all, pretty fast paced. But, you know, both the Nebraska and the Louisville one went to five. Mm-hmm. I think they took care of Arkansas in four. You know, that Louisville match, I mean, it was the Nebraska one was like neck and neck every one of those sets. The Louisville one was weird because, like, they didn't really play very well in the first set. It was a close second set, which Oregon won. And then Oregon just slaughtered Louisville in the third set. And then they got killed in the fifth set. I mean, that was hard to watch, actually. I was actually like sitting there like, you know, Coach Ulmer, what do you, you know, I don't care what you do. You got to do something. Cause like, you know, I think they had at one point like an 11-2 run against them. It was like nuts.
Yeah.
In a set that goes to only 15 in the fifth set, it goes to 15 instead of 25. And it's like, what is happening? You know, like, and especially in a match in which they had killed Louisville in an earlier set and were in a position. And it really just came down to that fourth set where, I mean, Oregon had match point. I mean, Louisville had a couple of match points too. And obviously, you know, that, or not match points at set point because they were behind by a set, but like, you know, Oregon had at least one match point that I can recall and just couldn't close the deal. And I mean, would have moved on. Yeah. I mean, win your match points, you know, hit your free throws, win your match points.
Right. Right. And, interestingly, the Oregon got to match point, off a kill from Mimi Collier, and then she was silent for the rest of the match.
Yeah, that was a little crazy. Kills.
And that's,
I mean,
kind
the rest
why...
of the match was, I think, only about. Oh, you know, you're right. She didn't have anything in the fifth set, did she?
Nope.
That was crazy.
Nothing at all.
I mean, she was involved. She was on the floor. It's just like she couldn't. You know, her spikes were getting blocked. You know, it was just. I mean, it was really interesting to watch both of those teams. Like be so hot and cold, and it wasn't just like one team that was hot and cold and the other team playing consistent. It was one team, you know, got hot when the other team got cold, and then vice versa. You know, that's sort of, you know, Oregon, you know, most of their matches this entire year has sort of been, you know, they killed them, you know, and if they lost a set, you know, they just sort of went cold in one set, but whatever, they shook it off and then won the other ones. Right. And this was like, I think the first time all year, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, if you can recall a different one in which it was like both teams had sort of that hot and cold phenomenon. I think that they're both teams that were sort of used to controlling matches.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it kind of underscores how much ahead the top 8 or 10 teams are in the country as compared to the rest of the field.
Well, sure.
All those teams are pretty evenly matched. So, you know, I don't think it's too unusual to run into a circumstance like that where, you know, you have really good teams trying to figure out the other really good team.
Yeah, I mean, you're just going to be, you know, I think, you know, one of the players was interviewed, I think it was Mimi, you know, after the Arkansas or Nebraska, you know, win. And you know, the first things out of her mouth is like, we knew at this point in the tournament that, like, every team that we play is going to be a killer, you know, like, you're going to be fighting, you know, every single time. And it's like, yeah. And you're right. I'm not sure where exactly the cliff is, but it's similar to women's basketball, where there's just like, I mean, let's face it, there's just not enough athletes at the top, you know, caliber to go around the entire power five, right? Like, it's just, you know, the body type that you need to play, you know, volleyball at the highest level is rare. And you know, there's just not enough of them. And, you know, Coach Ulmer has done a great job hoarding them, you know, all on one team. So much so that I actually, we were talking a little bit off air about, like, I've sort of been surprised, that, you know, Oregon's only lost one to the transfer portal, Roby, I believe. I got my fingers crossed that's, you know, it. I think that's, you know, that loss doesn't, you know, devastate me or anything, although I did like watching Roby play quite a bit. Definitely best hair on the team, in my opinion. Beyond that, a fantastic volleyball player, far more important. Almost as good hair as Coach Ulmer with the Doctor Strange. Like, do you think that's dyed? Do you think that's not natural? It can't be.
I think it is natural, and that's from having sat 3 feet away from him and talking with him. Doesn't mean that it's necessarily not, you know, manicured or, you know, however you want to put it. But there's, if he's dyeing his hair, he's got to be dyeing his beard also.
He's definitely going for a certain look. everybody involved in that team is, you know, very visually striking, and like, by which I mean, you can differentiate them from each other. And like, you know, when I was watching them play like these sort of Midwestern teams, you know, or you know, teams from the other side of the, you know, Rocky Mountains. And it's just like, boy, all these ladies look alike. Like, they're all identical, you know? And I'm like, or maybe it's just because I watch the Oregon team so much that, you know, that I'm able to tell them apart or whatever. But like, I don't know. I just really do like, you know, Oregon seemed like had a really diverse team. And beyond, you know, their backgrounds or whatever, I also mean that just like, you know, it's a bunch of different skill sets. You know, they weren't only winning points in a single way. And I felt like they were, you know, it seemed to me, and you tell me if you disagree, it seemed like it was a pretty deep team, you know, that if somebody wasn't available, you know, that they usually had somebody, you know, the Pukas, you know, losing the setter, you know, that's, it's apparently, you know, pretty difficult, and they weren't really playing anybody but the one libero. But like, you know, they had multiple killers, you know, like, you know, it didn't just all have to go through Collier, you know?
Right, inspired of having Morgan Lewis be sidelined a bit and then just slowly brought back into the rotation. You know, they were able to survive having an injury with a significant hitter, you know, just based on the, you know, their depth at the middle and outside hitter positions. It seemed like somebody would always step up. You know, Carson Bacon would find ways to step up. Carrie Roby would step up. Gloria Maturi. You know, I mean,
and I mean, how have we gone this long without talking about Brooke Nunneviller? You know, that's the, you know, it's a huge departure, but, you know, the thing that's remarkable is that, you know, how young this team is, right? Like, you know, Collier's a freshman, a bunch of other, you know, freshmen on the team, you know, who are leaders, you know, Roby was a sophomore, but like, you know, Dulles Reyes is a freshman, you know,
Colby Neal.
Right. Reagan Hope. There's more who are, you know, like, you know, Beck Morse, you know, who's one of the backup liberos, McClellan, you know, like they're losing Nunneviller and Roby's transferring out. And I think there's another senior that they're also losing, Maturi, right? Like,
yeah.
It's pretty manageable set of, like, you know, this team should be pretty good going forward.
They should, even though they are going to miss Brooke. Yeah. She's been the heart and soul of this team for 5 years now. And, you have a more difficult time replacing your field general and that player that motivates you and brings you up in spite of whatever's going wrong. And in that respect, she can't be replaced.
You know, but like, you know, they're bringing back Georgia Murphy, the libero, you know, they're bringing back Mimi Collier. They're bringing back, you know, almost all of their production, you know, you know, and a bunch of backups and you know, we'll see how their recruiting class goes. Well, maybe we'll cover that in the future, but like, you know, a lot of times when a team makes a deep run like this, which like this is the deepest run that Oregon's had since that 2012 season, right?
Right.
Yeah. Like it's a lot of times for a lot of teams in a lot of sports, that thing happens, you know, it's like, well, it's been 10 years. It's because sort of the stars align, you know, you like, you have a loaded class of seniors who are all stuck together, you know, and like, but that's it. You only get 1 year out of them. Then they all go their separate ways. That doesn't, you know, that doesn't look like that's going to be the case for next year's squad. You know, like next year's squad is going to look like this year's squad, maybe, you know, maybe on balance better, despite, you know, the you know, loss of Brooke and Muteri and Roby, like, you know, simply, you know, incremental improvement for all the folks who've returned, and then whatever additions that they get, you know, they're probably not done adding, you know, freshmen who are killers, you know, like they probably didn't, you know, that wasn't an accident that they got, you know, Mimi and some of the other folks, like, you know, I'm really looking forward to next year.
Yeah, it's a talented group of underclassmen, to be sure, and it's not unlike women's basketball. You know, with when Sabrina came on board, you know, they got to the Elite Eight in her freshman season, didn't they? And yeah. You know, all on the backs of some youngsters, and so you really had a sense that they weren't done. You know, they were going to be back for another year, 2 years, 3 years, and really put their stamp on the program. And that's kind of how I feel about this group.
Yeah, well, we're definitely looking forward to it. And you know, we'll, like I said, we'll have to see how recruiting goes. You know, there's probably, you know, this is a great, you know, proof, you know, like that, you know, Oregon's a serious volleyball school. And like, you want to play West Coast volleyball, and do it at the highest level. Like, you got two options and one of them requires getting into Stanford.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. We come back, we'll talk a little women's hoops.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So Oregon opened up their conference slate with one game and one game only, is but against Oregon State, their hated rivals, took revenge for the football side. It was actually, you know, pretty close game. Wound up being, I believe, an 8-point win for the Ducks, but you know, they but you know, it was tied, you know, pretty late. I thought that Oregon was basically in control of this game the entire time, you know, despite the fact that it was fairly close. You know, Oregon State, you know, put up a couple baskets late in the third quarter to make it close, and they had a little run again to make it close in the fourth quarter, but then Oregon sort of poured it on. And in particular, just a, you know, an absolute like career game, you know, for India Rogers, you know, 34 points, you know, my goodness. You know,
yeah,
shot well from the floor, hit every one of her free throws, which, you know,
eight for eight
on the free throw from the charity stripe, which, like, you know, I pound the table on that one every week. You know, hit your open free throws, but like, you know, shot 60%, you know, from the arc, you know, like, and like a couple of them were, you know, like those were the killers, you know, those were the dagger, you know, three pointers, you know, she just couldn't miss, you know, and she also had
what, 10 points or something in the first quarter. I mean, the Ducks really rode on her production in the beginning part of the game. And I get the sense that the Oregon State didn't catch up so much in the second quarter as yet the Ducks just weren't finding shots. They couldn't buy a shot there at the end of the half. And then, you know, Rogers again, you know, stuck the dagger in the Beavers, primarily off the free throws. I mean, those, every one of her free throws was just
they won by eight and she hit free, you know, the Ducks won by eight and she hit eight free throws, you know, there you go. Hit your free throws.
Yep. And the Ducks made sure that she was the one getting fouled. She had the hot hand. And so you come out with the win.
You know, there was a lot of, it wasn't just Rogers. It was definitely a team performance. The thing that was interesting to me, you know, watching that game, I think the, well, number one, I really like the, there's a chemistry with, Pow Pow and with Van Sluten, there that like, I don't know, for a second there, it sort of made me, you know, feel like I was watching the Golden Girls again. You know, like I was watching, you know, Satu and Ruthie and Sabrina. But then the other thing is, Filipina Che, good Lord, that is a big person. And like, I mean, I knew that she's sort of like, I knew that she's tall. I mean, she's the tallest player for Oregon, I believe, ever. Like, she's 6'8". Like, but like, I don't know, man. Like, it was, you know, because Oregon's sort of been playing, you know, the last couple of games have been playing some overmatched opponents. They're going to be playing a couple probably overmatched opponents coming up here, you know, against Eastern Washington and College of Charleston, in this next coming weeks. But, you know, Oregon State is a Pac-12 rival, and like, that's definitely a measuring stick, you know, kind of game. And like, you need like two measuring sticks, you know, to measure Che versus the Oregon State girls. It's just like they did not have an answer for her. She was taking rebounds, you know, at will, you know?
Yeah. I thought Oregon State's center played really well, and she's just as tall as Che is. She's a freshman. And so, I thought her play against Filipina was really good, you know, for being a youngster playing your first Pac-12 game against a ranked opponent. You know, she did cause some problems for Che, but Che's improving with every game, and. Yeah, she's going to be dynamite going into the Pac-12 season for sure.
Well, she gets Mitrovic, the center you're talking about, gets a rematch, you know, at the end, not the end of the year, the other game against Oregon State sort of smack dab in the middle of January. God, usually they finish up with that one. That's,
they kind of went cattywampus with the basketball schedule this year.
I'm looking at it now. It's kind of like, yeah, so they, you know, they come off the PK 85, in which, you know, they lost a heartbreaker to North Carolina. They had a great game against Michigan State. You know, then it's Portland, Oregon State. You know, that Pac-12 game sort of in the middle of a bunch of, you know, out of conference games, and then like Eastern Washington, College of Charleston, and then they go to another Invitational. They're going to the San Diego Invitational. They're going to play Arkansas to start out with. And then USF or Ohio State, depending on, you know, how those games go. It's a, you know, tournament kind of deal before they come back and start up with conference play again. I don't know. What are you looking forward to in this stretch? Like, what are you looking forward out of this team?
Well, I was kind of heartened at the way they were competitive against a team like North Carolina. And in spite of dropping that game, yep, they scored a lot of points, and they can keep up with just about anybody. So I'm kind of interested in seeing them advance. And in the San Diego Invitational, I'd have to look at the rankings, but Ohio State is typically highly ranked in women's basketball, and I'm interested in seeing how they match up against the likes of Ohio State.
I'm interested in seeing, well, I want a lot of floor time for Tahina Pau Pau, because, you know, like her floor shooting needs to improve, you know, despite Ndia Rogers having a phenomenal game, you know, they shot pretty poorly from the floor. And that's largely because, yep, you know, everybody else was well under, you know, 50%. And Tahina, I think she only hit four shots, you know, in the entire game, excluding free throws, from the floor. I mean,
yeah, it may have been a case where, you know, she recognized that, Rogers' hand was hot. So, you know,
sure,
feed it to the hot hand.
Well, okay, but she only had four assists. Too, you know, it's,
yeah,
you know, like, you know, I understand, obviously, the you know, Graves' passing system is a little more complicated than that. It's not just a single shovel. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, like, there's no, you know, yeah, she only made four shots on 15 attempts. Like, that's not good, you know. Nope. Like, and no, the other thing is, I'm really enjoying like all the rotation, you know, like they've been doing like different starting lineups, you know, every week. And I want to see like more experimentation. Like, I really think that they've got something in Jenna Tsai and Taya Hansen too. And like, they weren't, you know, starting this game, but I think they combined for like, you know, almost 30 minutes. And like, I want to see more, you know, like I want to see sort of different experimentation. That's really what,
right,
I'm looking for.
And yeah, you know, Jenna Tsai, when she's been in the game, has been about as good a six player as you can ask for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, her shooting is dynamite. And, but you're right about Pau Pau. You know, you're not always going to have a game where Chance Gray is hitting half her threes as well. And, yep, Pau Pau's capable of the three. Yeah, she's got to find that shot.
Well, like I said, Oregon's taking on Eastern Washington at Matt Knight Arena on Thursday, and then College of Charleston on Sunday. The other writers on the site are going to be covering those. You know, I'm looking forward to the games. Basketball on the men's side too is taking on a couple of, you know, non-conference, somewhat overmatched opponents. So it's sort of it's a tune-up week for Oregon basketball. Should be interesting to watch sort of the experimentation. And hopefully they are not close games.
Yeah, well, I sure hope that Will Richardson, you know, continues on the path that he has, because he had just a fantastic game.
Oh, yeah, first triple-double in a while.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. We come back, we'll talk about some of the transfer portal action on the football side.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
So, Bad Rider, you've got an article coming up talking about all the transfer portal stuff. You know, it has been, and this will be a historic offseason in that there's been a couple of transfer. There's not only the transfer portal rule that's changed, where, you know, now you have immediate eligibility and like no excuse transfers or no fault or whatever. You don't have to give like a reason or anything. And, you know, you combine it with some of the other things that have changed. Early signing day, is on the 21st this year, which is about 2 weeks and 3 days after the transfer portal window opens up. So, like, the transfers get the first shot at getting in. And for a lot of teams, may wind up bumping, you know, freshmen. Prep recruits. And then the other, you know, interesting thing is sort of a way of, because of COVID, they granted an eligibility holiday. So basically the entire 2020 season didn't count, like it didn't count for eligibility or for your clock, you know, ticking mm-hmm. forward. And there's sort of like a lot of teams find themselves having like a pretty big imbalance on their rosters. And so the NCAA, to help, you know, deal with that, it declared a 1 year, although some people think they may extend it to be 2 years, but a waiver of the initial counter rule. So there's two different caps in football that you got to worry about. You've got the overall 85 scholarship limit, cap, meaning, you know, all the people on your team, no matter what year in school they are, you can't have more than 85 scholarship, you know, athletes at once. And that rule hasn't gone anywhere. That's the total cap that you have to, you know, keep an eye on. But there's also this other rule that was introduced, like 10 years ago or so. It's basically to help deal with all the gray shirting and blue shirting and phantom shirting that teams in a certain part of the country were using to sort of, stack up their classes and recruit mm-hmm. like 50 dudes. It's the initial counter rule. And basically it says, you know, the initial counter says you can only add 25 new players, no matter where they're from, JUCOs, transfers, prep recruits, no matter what. And as soon as they set foot on campus, you know, and I think take a class, I forget exactly what exactly triggers it, but like the instant they do that, it eats up one of your 25, even if they, you know, have a cup of coffee and then take off, like the way that Jay Toya mm-hmm. did for USC to UCLA last year. Like it still counts against your initial counters. That's where the word counter comes from. Anyway, the NCAA has waived that. So now, you know, theoretically, if you wanted to, you could eliminate all 85 players off of your roster and take 85 new players. Theoretically, obviously nobody's doing that, but like theoretically that's possible this year. And so you have this confluence of, you know, a total liberty in the transfer portal, it opening earlier than early signing day and no initial counters to worry about. For a lot of teams that are in position where like they either have a new coaching staff or it's the second year for a new coaching staff and they couldn't, you know, they had to sort of deal with the hand that they were dealt in their first season. And now they're sort of, you know, this is their first opportunity to really remake the team, you know, as they want to, like, which is the position that Oregon is in. Like, boy, the transfer portal action is going to be real hot. And it already has been, you know, Oregon's had, I believe, 17 players transfer out and have brought in two so far. There's probably a lot more to come. So with that, you know, out of the way, you're going to be writing up this article. Has anything been a surprise? Anything really struck you as like sad or happy or what do you think?
Not really a surprise. The vast majority of the players looking to transfer out from Oregon haven't been utilized very much in
sure.
you know, the past couple of seasons or so. And it's no surprise. You're a player that's recruited as a 4 or 5 star. You've always been a star. And then you come to the Pac-12 level, and through injury or development or that kind of thing, you don't find field time. So everybody wants to play. And the players that I've seen, with a couple of exceptions, didn't have a whole lot of production this last season.
Yeah, it's not a huge hit to the immediate sort of production numbers. There's like you said, there's a couple of guys who were like, yeah, they were seeing some serious playing time, although they were not the top producers at those spots. Mm-hmm. But they hurt, you know, because they, you know, that wasn't potential out of them. That was like actual, you know, that was, you know, real production. Right. And then a couple of guys are sort of like, you know, they're backups in a crowded room. And you sort of get, you know, like Sean Dollars in the running back room. You know, I like Sean Dollars a lot. He's actually really valuable as a change of pace back.
And Cardwell.
Yeah. Sure. Same thing. I never really understood with Cardwell. I think there was an injury or something. I never really got a complete story out of them. And I know there's sort of some social media drama. I don't know. I don't want to really get into it. But obviously it's a crowded room, you know, and, you know, I guess where I'm going with this is like, you know, the other team in the Pac-12 that's had a ton of players transfer out is Stanford. But for Stanford, it's not, I mean, like these are the profile of Oregon's transfers out versus the profile of Stanford's transfers out are like, it's night and day, you know, like Stanford, it really looks like the from a program perspective, the bad kind of transfers. It looks like, you know, jumping off a sinking ship, you know, kind of, you know, where like those dudes are starters. Those dudes are like backbone of the team guys, you know, like their leading tackler, you know, on defense, like a couple of their starting offensive linemen, you know, guys with like eligibility left. And like, you know, I wasn't really wild about Stanford's team, to be honest, but like when starters transfer out, like, and it's a ton of them, right? Whereas with Oregon, it's like, it's guys who are either not really seeing the field or at the very least were backups or like guys who are like, you know, guys like, you know, Sean Dollars or guys like, there's a few others, you know, Jackson LeDuc, you know, in the linebacking core where it's like, you could see it, you could see the development and you could see that like, okay, in a year or two, you could really definitely be like a starter, you know, like you could really be contributing. And like, I don't think that you're a bust. I do think there are some of the players on this Oregon transfer list that are busts, which like those happen, you know, like, let me put a pin in that and come back to it. But like, there's dudes like Jackson Duke where you're like, I don't think that you're a bust. I think that you were on a trajectory to be a contributor and it just hasn't happened yet. And so like, that's still less painful than the Dante Thornton type of, you know, departure where it's like, oh yeah, that production really was for real.
And that's the one that, Oregon will especially miss. And, you know, they're obviously looking, for ways by way of the transfer portal to fill that gap. Cause yeah, Thornton is a significant, you know, he's a significant loss into the transfer portal.
But like almost everybody else, you know, on this list or, you know, virtually the entire list, it's not the Stanford list. You know, it's not the like, oh my God, what are they going to do without him? You know, it's guys who are leaving crowded rooms. It's guys who are sort of like it's potential, but it's not actual yet. And then other guys who are, they're just busts. And I mean, I don't think we really need to name names, but you know, like I said, I put a pin in and I come back to it. So here we are. Like I maintain an entire, you know, player database for the entire Pac-12, every team in the Pac-12 and also all of Oregon's, you know, I use the same database tools for all of Oregon's, you know, big opponents. So, you know, Georgia and Ohio State and North Carolina I've constructed, you know, for the bowl game that's coming up and so forth. And like, and in order to construct those, I have to go back to their last several recruiting classes and I have to track all the players who have left and like, where did their production go, you know, and that sort of thing. You know, use exactly all these same tools. So like, and like what I have found is this iron law, and it's true of every single team, no exceptions, none, not a single exception, is the rule of thirds, that any given recruiting class or any given, like, no matter how you want to divide it up, you know, at position over time or, you know, what, any group that you care to draw a circle around, you are going to find the rule of thirds where a third of those dudes are going to be, you know, starting contributors for you. A third of them are going to be busts and just basically never play for you, you know, not seriously or whatever, and they're going to transfer out or medically retire or you know, there's going to be, you know, injury problems such that they never really see the field or just like that turns out that they're not very good, you know, athletes that are you know, not capable of competing at this level, you know, despite what their talent evaluation was from the scouting services. Like, it just happens, you know, like it happens to everyone. And like, And then the final third is like in between, you know, which I you know, guys who like you get a good year out of and then they get hurt and you never see them again, or like they're career backups, but they never really rise to the starter level, or, you know, there's a couple of, I don't need to belabor this point, in between. And it just,
well, that's a fascinating stat, you know, to have that kind of a stat reach so broadly across every team. It's just kind of
every
fascinating
team in every year. And yeah. And here's the deal. Like every, if you talk to any football fan, they will tell you that their team develops players better than anybody else. And that they, and when I tell them the rule of thirds, their response is like, yeah, but for us, it's not 33% hit. It's, you know, we're hitting on like 40, 50% of our guys, and our busts, it's only like maybe 10% of guys, you know? And it's like, no, it's not. You know, and then you ask them like, well, what do you think you know, your rival does? Oh, our rivals are jackasses and clowns and they're star chasers and their bust rate is probably like 50% and they're only hitting on like 10% of their guys. Like it's like the total mirror image of our team. It's just like, dude, you're making a fool of yourself, you know? And yet that's like all of Twitter. Every single person that you would poll on Twitter would tell you that, you know, and they're all like publicly proclaiming themselves to be fools because of course they didn't have gathered the data in order to make those assessment. That's entirely a gut based thing. And their gut is wrong and it's informed by their emotions and their emotions are stupid. And it's, you know, why these people are not like serious and I don't care to engage with them very often. It is, you know, like, you know, now look, you take 24 guys, that means 8 of them are going to be hits and 8 of them are going to be busts. And sometimes, you know, on occasion you find one school in one year where it's like 10-6, you know, one way or the other, you know, they had a lucky year and an unlucky year, but that's it. You know, like it's one year and it's only like a dude or two, you know, beyond, you know, the expected level. It's never sustainable to the point where you were like, oh, what a great staff. You know, they found a bunch of diamonds in the rough. Just like, no, you didn't. Like it doesn't happen. All those cliches are just, they're lies. And so anyway, like all of this is just to say that, like, yeah, Oregon shedding this many dudes, you know, some of whom are busts, like that doesn't mean anything. Like their bust rate is the normal bust rate. Like, and anybody who, and here's the other thing that's important is that, like, it doesn't matter what their star rating is. Star rating does not predict bust or no bust, or, you know, bust versus hit. What star rating is, that if they hit, that means that what they can do is better than what their, you know, the people who are lower rated than them can do. So like a 5-star who hits can run faster and hit harder than a 3-star who hits, but it doesn't mean that he's more likely to hit than the 3-star is. That is just, you know, I don't know what goes into it, but it appears to just be like fate or, you know, random chance. And so, like, on balance, you want to assemble a bunch of 5-stars because that means, you know, if you have, you know, if you have 65 stars on your team, then 20 of them are going to hit, and 25 stars, you know, hit like Mack trucks, you know, and the other team that's made up of 63 stars, of whom 20 hit, like, are going to hit like, I don't know, Miatas, you know, like, it's just, you know, that's what the star rating means. It means like, what is your potential? What is your ceiling? But whether or not you max out and hit that ceiling, I'm sorry, it appears to just be random. So like, for anybody who's sweating, like, oh my God, look at all these busts on this. Look at all these, you know, first of all, these are not rats jumping off a sinking ship. That's not the case for Oregon. Like, it is the case, I think, for some other schools, but that doesn't appear to be the case for Oregon. And second of all, like, it's, you know, the idea that, like, oh my God, look at all these busts in this list. I'm so, like, I was so hyped about this dude when he arrived and now he's gone and he never worked out. And now I'm sad. And like, what a terrible, you know, bunch of developers or like the recruiting staff that acquired them. Like they didn't know what they were doing. They were star chasing. Like, oh my God, they didn't, like, nah, man. Like, I'm telling you, every position, it's a normal bust rate. It's totally normal. And of course it is, because every team is a normal bust rate. Like there's very little variation. So like,
yeah,
you know,
the players themselves, aren't going to look at that kind of situation in a statistical manner. You know,
yeah, of course.
I was a five star. You know, why am I not playing? There's a lot of understandable emoting that is going on in the heads of each and every one of those players that are transferring out. Yeah,
and I mean,
they just want to play.
I mean, that is obviously true, but I mean, it's not entirely their decision. You know, they're getting. You know, that's why I started off talking about, like, you know, the waiver, the initial transfer rule, and the remaking of the roster, which is going to be enormous. Like this roster, you know, I was on a different podcast, and one of the hosts pointed out that, like, okay, grab the two deep from the Fresno State opener in 2021. And put that side by side next to the two deep for the opener in 2023. There's going to be like three guys who are on both lists, you know, like it's not going to be unrecognizable. And in fact, our job at Addicted to Quack is going to be, you know, in some ways to introduce some of these new players to Oregon fans. And like one of the cool things about transfers is that I have a bunch of college film on them. I don't have to deal with just like huddle tapes that are highlight reels of your best play from this being shot from a cell phone from some dude in the stands. And, you know, on Friday night, like I've got real college film that, you know, for some of these like key transfers who are coming in, like, yeah, man, you better believe that's going to be an offseason project for me. I'm looking forward to it. You know, where I can be like, this is this dude's performance. Like I did that for 2020, you know, cause the season got started late because of COVID, you know? And so it was like, oh, I can go look at some of these transfers who are coming in. So I looked at Anthony Brown's tape from Boston College. And I looked at, Bennett Williams tape from Illinois and, San Mateo, you know, and, in fact, Bennett Williams, funny story is, did you watch Last Chance U on Netflix?
I did not. No.
Their last season, they followed Lacey College, and they were coming off of a year in which they won, you know, a version of the JUCO National Championship, and they were not having as good a year in the year that Last Chance U was following them. But if they won a particular game, they could have gone back to the playoffs, and the game was against San Mateo, and that was the year or one of the 2 years that Bennett Williams was playing for them. And in fact, there is a play at the very end of that game where, you know, if Lacey scores a touchdown, they're on the goal line. If they score a touchdown, they might win the game. And you know who makes the tackle, who prevents them from getting that touchdown and winning that game and going back to the playoffs?
Of course.
It's Bennett Williams. And I actually found that clip in Last Chance U and put a clip of that, you know, in my article with attribution, of course. You know, like if you can identify a villain in Last Chance U for that season, you could make an argument it's Bennett Williams. Yeah. Now, obviously, narratively, that's not true. The villains are the demons within all of us that causes us to, you know, not be able to, or, you know, certain players not to be able to achieve their full potential. You know, that's, you know, really, it's a story about human development. But people at their last chance. But if you could locate it in a traditional narrative sense of an externalized human being, yeah, Bennett Williams, you know, that was real fun. So anyway, I did that for 2020. I sort of like looked at a bunch of the transfer players, you know, who had college film that I put together. And like, I'm looking forward to doing sort of similar project. We will see how it goes. There are two guys who come in that I definitely know I'm going to be writing about, and you get the first crack at them. The two new transfers so far that Oregon have gotten, what do you got to say about those guys?
Well, I still have to do some looking at them, but Jacobs and Holden definitely the Ducks are following the pattern of what they did last offseason, where they really utilized the transfer portal well.
They cleaned up, filling, man. I mean, they got a bunch of home run hitters, right? Like, let's go down who they got. For this last, which let's all remember, the first thing this staff did once it was assembled was get players out of the transfer portal. You know, it wasn't, you know, prep for the opener against Georgia. It wasn't like devise what the offensive scheme is going to be. It wasn't figuring out the practice schedule. It was get these dudes out of the portal. And who do they get? They get Bo Nix, Bucky Irving, Noah Whittington, Chase Cota,
Gonzalez.
Christian Gonzalez, they got Taki Taimani and Casey Rogers and the third guy from Nebraska, whose name is escaping me, but who's Jordan Riley. I think they took one more, Chapman from Texas A&M, who continued to be injured, and he wasn't really productive for Oregon. But like everybody else, mm-hmm. home run hitters. Every one of those dudes were starters. Like, and that wasn't because they were playing favorites or anything. It's not like they shouldn't have been starters. Like, this staff has an excellent eye for transfer portal talent, and I'm really looking forward to who else they get. But so far, they've gotten to Justin Jacobs from Iowa, who's a linebacker. He had a really great 2021, and then I think he missed much of 2022 with an injury, but he was like in line to be their, you know, next great linebacker. Iowa fans were really pissed off that they lost him to Oregon. And then Trayshon Holden, the wide receiver from Alabama, you know, who's had, you know, like 570 yards in his career so far in a, you know, in arguably the best wide receiver room in the country over the last 2 years. Yeah.
Right. And two positions of need. Oregon's got other positions of need. And so it'll be interesting where they draw from in the transfer portal. Because the transfer portal these days is just as important. Maybe I wouldn't go so far as to say it's more important than your recruiting.
Well, but I mean,
it's definitely a significant element.
I'll say it. It's more important to your immediate success. You know, if you've got holes to fill, you know, Oregon recruits at a level that if they get a true freshman who hits, he can really be a difference maker at this level, which is not something that a lot of teams in the Pac-12 can say. So like if there's an exception to what I'm about to say, Oregon may be it in terms of like, you know, no, go ahead and get prep recruits. Like, take a 5-star prep recruit because that dude is a true freshman, is better than he has proved himself 3-star from a different program. But for everybody else, and probably Oregon included, man, you want to win right away. You better make the transfer portal the centerpiece of your additions this year. Like, I mean, it's just like virtually every quarterback in the Pac-12 last year or, you know, last season was a transfer, you know, like UCLA, virtually every one of their defensive starters was a transfer. I'm not joking about that. Virtually every one of their defensive starters, I think it was 10 out of 11 were transfers. And I mean, their defense was garbage and they fired their defensive coordinator finally. And like, how do they rebuild it? You know, it almost entirely transfer.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And that's it. That's just, especially with quarterbacks, you know, other positions as well. But with the quarterbacks, that's going to be kind of the paradigm going forward.
Well, here's another like lesson that I've learned from database construction and management is that, there's just about every position on the field. There's no such thing as, oh, he sucked at his previous school or he's only mediocre at his previous school. But at my school, he'll be a killer because we've got such great developers. Like that's sort of my running theme is there's no such thing as great developers. Like the idea that there's a staff that squeezes, you know, coal into diamonds, like, no, that doesn't exist. Like, it just doesn't. Like your delusional fan who if you believe that is the case, guys play at the same level that is determined by their talent level, you know, no matter what the school is. There are two exceptions, or maybe like one and a half exception. One of those is defensive line, but that's only if you're the wrong body type for an even versus an odd front, and it may be a little too technical to get into, you know, but like the way that you construct an even front and the way that you construct an odd front, you know, defensive line, you are looking for a different configuration of body types. And if you're on the wrong type, then like, even though you may be a really good player, you don't really fit with that. And you need to transfer to a school that runs a system that where your body type is more useful. Now, of course, if you screw that up, if you're a 3-down player and you transfer from a 4-down team to another 4-down team, then that's not going to work out for you, you know.
Right, and with the kind of turnover that we see in coaching staffs, it's it's not uncommon for a good player in a certain scheme to, not be the right player for the next coach, and you hit the transfer portal.
Yeah, which is, but now you can do that on an unlimited basis, so go ahead. But the end, but anyway, the reason why I say that's only like half of one is because it's still constrained. Like if you make the wrong choice, you can still wind up, not really, playing any different. But the one that sort of defies all of that, the exception to the rule, is the quarterbacks. And you see it over and over and over again. Quarterback performance, it does appear to be heavily dependent on scheme, on protection, on your receiving options, and on how much, for lack of a better term, you just click with the coaching staff, the head coach and your quarterback's coach and your offensive coordinator. Because we've seen it over and over and over again. It's not a guarantee or anything, but quarterbacks go from a situation that wasn't working for them at their old school, and then it does work for them at the new school in a way that doesn't happen for any other position, and you're fantasizing if you think that it will. But a quarterbacks, it can happen. It's not a guarantee, but it can happen. And I mean, every Oregon fan ought to know it. They watched it, with Bo Nix, from Auburn to Oregon, where completely different situation in terms of his offensive line protection and scheme and receiving options, and it did wonders for him. No real surprise that I think it's in 10 out of the 12 starting quarterbacks in the Pac-12 in the 2022 season were transfers, because that can happen, I am looking forward to seeing how the quarterback position winds up playing out at Oregon. And finding transfer quarterbacks is more viable than ever before. And you could make an argument, a pretty strong argument, that it is necessary at this point. It may be that going forward, it's foolish not to take a quarterback out of the transfer portal, who's, the old model of you recruit a prep quarterback every single year, and that way you have a dude at each different point in his development and year in school to pick from, and you would pull down a grad transfer quarterback as the old man in the room as your safety net. I think that model's probably out the window. I think probably the model going forward is that you're going to take one, definitely maybe two or even three transfer quarterbacks who have multiple years of eligibility left, and that everybody's basically trading quarterbacks, each year, and that you'll take prep recruits to develop them in your hip pocket, but your primary option, it may be that we're looking at an era in which the most schools' primary option at quarterback are transfers. Transfers with multiple years of eligibility, not the grad transfer safety net type.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense, because if you have a transfer, you have a known quantity.
Sure.
With a incoming
or a known set of potential. You can watch Bo Nix and see that dude's a very accurate quarterback, and you can see where the problems. Like if you watch tape on Bo Nix, you could see where the problems were, and you could see that the problems weren't his fault. Mm-hmm. So known quantity in the sense of looking just the stupid look at their production numbers, which a lot of football commentators did. And I spent a lot of time dunking on them. We're just like, oh, we know who Bo Nix is. He'll never improve. And I'm like, you're going to eat those words, dude. And then I made them do that. But known quantity in terms of what is their potential, what is their capability? We've seen how they react to Power Five defenses. Yes, that is definitely true. If not, they're actual with their potential. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing with quarterbacks. It's such a central, I mean, that's an understatement. There is no position in American sports in which, it's a team sport, but in another sense, it's a one man sport than quarterback in football. And buying a pig in a poke, which is, what going with prep recruits, who've never played before, that may be untenable, for most teams, most years going forward.
Yep. It's interesting times for sure.
All right. I think that's going to do it for us this week. I'm looking forward to your article on the transfer portal to date and going forward as well.
We're going to talk. I'm going to talk a little bit about the good and the bad. Yeah, just because a player enters the transfer portal doesn't mean that their situation necessarily improves. I mean, sure. There's a sizable percentage where the transfer portal option doesn't work out. And I'll be talking a little bit about that.
I mean, that's going to happen. You know, there's, you know, I've seen some stats that are kind of like, you know, there's more players in the transfer portal now than there have been in like the last three years combined, you know, stuff like that. You know, don't quote me for fact on that, you know, one, but, you know, stats along those lines, just like this is unprecedented. It's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out. All right. I think that's going to wrap it up this week. Any parting words of wisdom for us, Badwater?
No, go Ducks.
All right.
That's my usual words of wisdom.
Words to live by as well. Yeah. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll catch you on the flip side.